it already. He moved his hand away from the sword. Lifting his pipe, he saw Bane watching him. The boy's lips curved in a sweet, charming smile. Chapter 29. Wome Drevlin, Low Realm. The High Froman was having a sad time of it. He was being plagued by gods. Literally dropping from the skies, gods rained down on his defenseless head. Nothing was going right. His once peaceful realm, that had not known a whisper of trouble in the last several centuries, was now running amok. Trudging across the Coralite, his band of coppers marching along reluctantly behind him, the head clerk marching righteously at his side, the Froman thought long and hard about gods, and decided that he hadn't much use for them. First, instead of neatly getting rid of Mad Limbeck, the gods had actually had the audacity to send him back alive. Not only that, but they came with him. Well, one of them did, a god who called himself Haplow. And though confused reports had reached the ears of the High Froman that the god didn't consider himself a god, Darrow Longshoreman didn't believe it for a flicker. Unfortunately, whether this Haplow was or he wasn't, he was stirring up trouble wherever he went, and that was pretty nearly everywhere, including now the Geg's capital city of Wome. Mad Limbeck and his wild whups were dragging the god across the countryside, making speeches, telling the people that they were being misused, ill-treated, enslaved, and the Mangers knew what else. Of course, Mad Limbeck had been ranting and raving about this for some considerable length of time, but now, with the god standing at his side, the Geggs were beginning to listen to him. Half the clerks had been completely won over. The head clerk, seeing his church falling apart around him, was demanding that the High Froman do something. "And what am I supposed to do?" Darrow asked sourly. "Arrest this Haplow, this god who says he isn't a god? That won't do anything except convince the people who do believe in him that they've been right all along and convince the rest who don't that they should." "Bosh," sniffed the head clerk, who hadn't understood a thing the High Froman said, but who knew he didn't agree with it. "Bosh, that's all you've got to say. It's all your fault anyhow," the High Froman shouted, working himself into a rage. "Let the Mangers take care of Mad Limbeck, you said. Well, they took care of him all right. Sent him back to destroy us." The head clerk had stormed off in a huff, but he'd been back quick enough when the ship was sighted. Plummeting out of the skies, where it had no business being, since it wasn't time for the monthly festival yet, the dragon ship had landed in the outland some distance away from an outer sector of Wome known as Stomach. The High Froman had seen it from his bedroom window and his heart had sunk. More gods, just what he needed. At first, Darrow thought he might have been the only one to see it, and that he could pretend he hadn't. No such luck. A number of other Geggs saw it, including the head clerk. Worse still, one of his sharp-eyed, no-brains coppers had reported seeing something alive come out of it. The copper, as punishment, was now stumbling along after his chief on their way to investigate. "I guess this'll teach you," Darrow rounded on the unfortunate copper. "It's because of you we're being forced to come out here. If you'd kept your lips from flapping. But no, you have to go and see one of them. Not only that, but you have to shout it out to half the realm."
"I only said it to the head clerk," protested the copper.
"It's the same thing," Darrow muttered.
"Well, but I think it's only right that we have our own god now, High Froman," persisted the copper. "'Tisn't fair to my mind, those clods in Het having a god and us going without. I reckon this'll show 'em."
The head clerk raised an eyebrow. Anger forgotten, he sidled over to the High Froman.
"He does have a point," murmured the clerk in Darrow's ear. "If we have our own god, we can use him to counter Limbeck's god."
Stumbling along over the cracked and gouged Coralite, the High Froman had to admit that his brother-in-law had, for once in his life, come up with something that sounded halfway intelligent. "My own god," mused Darrow Longshoreman, squelching through the puddles, heading for the dragon ship. "There's got to be some way to work this to my advantage." Seeing that they were nearing the wrecked dragon ship, the High Froman slowed his march, raising his hand to warn those behind him to slow theirs, something that was not necessary. The coppers had already come to a standstill about 10 feet behind their leader. The High Froman glared at his men in exasperation and started to curse them all for cowards. But on second thought, he considered that it was probably just as well his men remained behind. It would look better if he treated with the gods alone. He cast a sidelong glance at the head clerk.
"I think you should stay here," said Darrow. "It might be dangerous."
Since Darrow Longshoreman had never in his entire life been concerned about his welfare, the head clerk was very rightly suspicious at this sudden consideration, and promptly and unequivocally refused.
"It's only proper that a churchman greet these immortal beings," said the head clerk loftily. "I suggest, in fact, that you allow me to do the talking."
The storm had cleared, but there was another coming, On Drevlin, there was always another coming. And Darrow didn't have time to argue. Contenting himself with muttering that the head clerk could talk all he wanted through a split lip, the high foreman and his cohort turned and marched, with a remarkable courage that would later be celebrated in story and song, right up to the battered hull of the downed ship. The courage exhibited by the two Geggs should not, after all, be considered that remarkable, the copper having reported that the creature he had seen emerge from the ship was small and puny-looking. Their true courage would be tested shortly. Standing next to the damaged hull, the high foreman was momentarily at a loss. He'd never spoken to a god before. At the monthly sacred docking ceremonies, the Welves appeared in their huge winged ships, sucked up the water, threw down their reward, and departed. Not a bad way of doing things, the high foreman thought regretfully. He was just opening his mouth to announce to the small, puny-looking god inside the ship that his servants were here when there emerged a god who was anything but small and puny-looking. The god was tall and dark, with a black beard that hung in two braids from his chin and long black hair that flowed over his shoulders. His face was hard, his eyes as sharp and cold as the coralite on which the Geggs stood. The god carried in his hand a weapon of bright, glittering steel. At the sight of this formidable, frightening creature, the head clerk, forgetting completely about church protocol, turned and fled. Most of the coppers, seeing the church abandoning the field, figured doom had descended and took to their heels. Only one stalwart copper remained, the one who had sighted the god and had reported it to be small and puny. Perhaps he thought he had nothing to lose.
"Humph! Good riddance," muttered Darrow.
Turning to the god, he bowed so low his long beard dragged the wet ground.
"Your worship," said the high foreman humbly, "we welcome you to our realm. Have you come for the judgment?"
The god stared at him, then turned to another god. The foreman inwardly groaned, how many of these were there? And spoke something to this second god in words that were a meaningless babble to the high foreman. The second god, a bald, weak, soft-looking god, if you ask Darrow Longshoreman, shook his head, a blank expression on his face. And it occurred to the high foreman that these gods hadn't understood a word he'd said. In that instant, Darrow Longshoreman realized that Mad Limbeck wasn't mad after all. These weren't gods. Gods would have understood him. These were mortal men. They had come in a dragon ship, which meant that the Welves in their dragon ships were most likely mortal. If the Kixiwinzi had suddenly ceased to function, if every whirly had stopped whirling, every gear stopped grinding, every whistle stopped tooting, the high foreman could not have been more appalled. Mad Limbeck was right. There would be no judgment. They would never be lifted up to Geg's hope. Glowering at the gods and at their wrecked ship, Darrow realized that the gods themselves couldn't even get off Drevlin. A low rumble of thunder warned the high foreman that he and these gods didn't have time to stand around and stare at one another. Disillusioned, angry, needing time to think, the high foreman turned his back on the gods and started to head for his city.
"Wait," came a voice. "Where are you going?"
Startled, Darrow whirled around. A third god had appeared. This must have been the one the copper had seen, for this god was small and frail-looking. This god was a child. And had Darrow only imagined it, or had the child spoken to him in words he understood?
"Greetings, I am Prince Bane," said the child in excellent but halting Geg, sounding almost as if he were being prompted.
One hand was clasped tightly around a feather amulet he wore on his breast. He held out his other hand, palm open, in the ritual Geg gesture of friendship.
"My father is Sinistrad, Mysteriarch of the Seventh House, ruler of the High Realm."
Darrow Longshoreman drew in a deep, shivering breath. Never in his life had he seen such a beautiful being as this. Bright golden hair, bright blue eyes, the child glistened like the shining metal of the Kixiwinzi. "Perhaps I've been mistaken. Mad Limbeck is wrong, after all. Surely this being is immortal. Somewhere from deep within the Geg, buried beneath centuries of sundering, holocaust, and rupture, came a phrase to Darrow's mind, "And a little child shall lead them."
"Greetings, Prince Bane," returned the high foreman, stumbling over the name that held in his language no meaning. "Have you come to pass judgment on us at last?"
The child's eyelids flickered. Then he said coolly,
"Yes, I have come to judge you. Where is your king?"
"I am the High Foreman, your worship, ruler of my people. It would be a great honor if you would deign to visit our city, your worship."
The High Foreman's gaze strayed nervously to the approaching storm. Gods probably weren't bothered by bolts of lightning sizzling down from the heavens, and Darrow found it somewhat embarrassing to hint that High Foremen were. However, the child appeared to be cognizant of the Geg's plight, and to take pity on it. Casting a glance back at his two companions, whom Darrow now took for the god's servants or guards, Prince Bade indicated he was ready to travel and glanced about for the conveyance.
"I'm sorry, your worship," muttered the High Froman, flushing warmly, "but we have to, walk."
"Oh, that's all right," said the god, and jumped gleefully into a puddle. Chapter 30. Wom Drevlin, Low Realm. Limbeck was sitting in the drafty headquarters of WUP, writing the speech he would deliver at the rally tonight. His spectacles perched precariously on his head, the geg scribbled his words onto the paper, happily spattering ink over everything and completely oblivious of the chaos erupting around him. Haplow sat near him, the dog at his feet. Quiet, taciturn, unobtrusive, indeed going almost unnoticed, the patron lounged in a geg chair that was too short for him. His long legs extending out in front of him, he idly watched the organized confusion. His cloth-wound hand dropped occasionally to scratch the dog on the head or to pat it reassuringly in the event that something startled it. WUP headquarters in the geg capital city of Wom was, literally, a hole in the wall. The Kixiwinzi had once decided it needed to expand in a certain direction, knocked a hole in the wall of a geg dwelling, then had apparently decided, for some unknown reason, that it didn't want to go that way after all. The hole in the wall remained, and the 20 or so geg families who had occupied the dwelling had moved, since one could never be certain but that the Kixiwinzi might change its mind again. Beyond a few minor inconveniences, such as the perpetual draft, it was, however, ideal for the establishment of WUP headquarters. There had been no WUP headquarters in the capital of Drevlin. The High Froman and the Church both held crushing power here. But after Limbeck's triumphant return from the dead, bringing with him a god who claimed he wasn't a god, reached Wom via the news singers, the Geggs clamored to know more about WUP and its leader. Jara herself traveled to Wom to establish the union, distribute pamphlets, and find a suitable building to serve both as center of operations and a place to live. Her primary secret goal, however, was to discover if the High Froman and or the Church was going to give them trouble. Jara hoped they would. She could almost hear the news singers across the land warbling, "Coppers, crush, converts." Nothing of the sort had occurred, much to Jara's disappointment, and Limbeck and Haplow and the dog were met by cheering crowds when they entered the city. Jara hinted that this was undoubtedly a dark and subtle plot by the High Froman to ensnare them all, but Limbeck said it simply proved that Darrow Longshoreman was fair and open-minded. Now crowds of gegs stood outside the hole in the wall, craning their necks to catch a glimpse of the famous Limbeck or of his god who wasn't. WUP members rushed importantly in and out, bearing messages to or from Jara, who was so busy running things that she didn't have time to make speeches anymore. Jara was in her element. She led WUP with ruthless efficiency. Her skills in organization, her inherent knowledge of the gegs, and her management of Limbeck had been responsible for setting the gegs' world aflame with anger and the call for revolution. She poked, prodded, and pummeled Limbeck into shape, shoved him forth to issue words of genius, and hauled him back when it was time to quit. Her awe of Haplow soon faded, and she began to treat him the same way she treated Limbeck, telling him what to say and how long to say it. Haplow submitted to her in everything with easy, casual pliability. He was, Jara discovered, a man of few words, but those words had a way of searing into the heart, leaving a mark that burned long after the iron had grown cool. "Is your speech ready for tonight, Haplow?" She paused in the act of drafting a reply to an attack that the Church had made on them, an attack so simple-minded that to answer it was to give it more credence than it deserved. "I will say what I always say, if that is agreeable to you, madam," he replied with the quiet respect that marked all his dealings with the Geggs. "Yes," said Jara, brushing her chin with the end of a feather quill. "I think that will be most satisfactory. You know that we are likely to draw our biggest crowd yet. They say that some scrifts are even talking of walking off the job, a thing absolutely unprecedented in the history of Drevlin." Limbeck was startled enough by the tone of her voice to lift his myopic gaze from his paper and stare vaguely in her general direction. In reality, all he could see of her was a squarish blur surmounted by a lump that was her head. He couldn't see her eyes, but he knew her well enough to envision them sparkling with pleasure. "My dear, is that wise?" he said, holding his pen poised above the paper and unconsciously allowing a large drop of ink to splat right in the center of his text. "It's certain to anger the High Froman and the clerks."
"I hope it does," Jara stated emphatically, much to Limbeck's consternation.
Nervously, he set his elbow in the ink splot.
"Let him send his coppers to break up our meeting," Jara continued. "We'll gain hundreds more followers."
"But there could be trouble," Limbeck was aghast. "Someone could get hurt."
"All in the name of the cause." Jara shrugged, then returned to her work. Limbeck dropped another inkblot. "But my cause has always been peace. I never meant for people to get hurt." Rising to her feet, Jara cast a swift, meaningful glance at Haplow, reminding Limbeck that the god who wasn't was listening. Limbeck flushed and bit his lip, but shook his head stubbornly, and Jara moved over to his side. Lifting up a rag, she wiped away a particularly large ink spot on the end of his nose. "My dear," she said, not unkindly, "you've always talked about the need for change. How did you think it would happen?"
"Gradually," said Limbeck, "gradually and slowly, so that everyone has time to get used to it and comes to see that it is for the best."
"That is so like you," sighed Jara. A whopper stuck his head through the hole in the wall, seeking to attract Jara's attention. She frowned at him severely, and the geg appeared slightly daunted, but held his ground, waiting. Turning her back on the whopper, Jara smoothed Limbeck's wrinkled brow with a hand rough and calloused from hard work. "You want change to come about nicely and pleasantly. You want to see it just sort of slip up on people so that they don't notice it until they wake up one morning and realize that they're happier than they were before. Isn't that true, Limbeck?" Jara answered her own question. "Of course it is. And it's very wonderful and very thoughtful of you, and it's also very naive and very stupid." Leaning down, she kissed him on the crown of the head to rob her words of their sting. "And it's just what I love about you, my dear. But haven't you been listening to Haplow, Limbeck? Give part of your speech now, Haplow." The whopper, who had been waiting to see Jara, turned to shout to the crowd, "Haplow is going to give his speech!" The geg standing in the street broke into rousing cheers, and as many as could possibly fit squeezed heads, arms, legs, and other body parts in through the hole in the wall. This somewhat alarming sight caused the dog to leap to its feet. Haplow patted the dog down and obligingly began to orate, speaking loudly in order to be heard above the crunch, whiz, bang of the kicksy-winsy. "You, gegs, know your history. You were brought here by those you call the Mangers. In my world they are known as the Sartan, and they treated us as they did you. They enslaved you, forced you to work on this thing that you know as the kicksy-winsy. You consider it to be a living entity, but I tell you that it's a machine, nothing more. A machine kept running by your brains, your brawn, your blood. And where are the Sartan? Where are these so-called gods who claim that they brought you, a gentle, peaceful people, here to protect you from the Welves? They brought you here because they knew they could take advantage of you. Where are the Sartan? Where are the Mangers? That is the question we must ask. No one, it seems, knows the answer. They were here, and now they're gone, and they've left you to the mercy of the minions of the Sartan, those Welves you were taught to believe were gods. But they're not gods, either, any more than I am a god, except for the fact that they live like gods. Live like gods because you are their slaves, and that's how the Welves think of you. It's time to rise up, throw off your chains, and take what is rightfully yours. Take what has been denied you for centuries." Wild applause from the gegs peering through the hole cut him off. Jara, eyes shining, stood with clasped hands, her lips moving to the sound of the words which she had memorized. Limbeck listened, but his eyes were downcast, his expression troubled. Though he too had heard Haplow's speech often, it seemed that only now was he really hearing it for the first time. Words such as blood, rise up, throw off, take, leapt up, growling like the dog at Haplow's feet. He had heard them, perhaps even said them himself, but they had been only words. Now he saw them as sticks and clubs and rocks. He saw gegs lying in the streets, or being herded off to prison, or being made to walk the steps of Terrell Fenn. "I never meant this," he cried, "any of this." Jara, her lips pressed tightly together, strode over, and with a vicious jerk, flung down the blanket that had been hung up over the hole in the wall. There were disappointed murmurings from the crowd whose view inside was cut off. "Whether you did or you didn't, Limbeck, it's gone too far now for you to stop it," she snapped. Seeing the harried expression on her beloved's face, she softened her voice. "There are pain and blood and tears at every birth, my dear. The baby always cries when it leaves its safe, quiet prison. Yet if it stayed in the womb, it would never grow, never mature. It would be a parasite feeding off another body. That's what we are. That's what we become. Don't you see? Can't you understand?" "No, my dear," said Limbeck. The hand holding the pen was shaking. Ink drops were flying everywhere. He laid it down across the paper on which he'd been writing and slowly rose to his feet. "I think I'll go out for a walk." "I wouldn't," said Jara. "The crowds..." Limbeck blinked.
"Oh, yes. Of course, you're right."
"You're exhausted. All this traveling and excitement. Go lie down and take a nap. I'll finish your speech. Here are your spectacles," Jara said briskly, plucking them from the top of Limbeck's head and popping them onto his nose. "Up the stairs and into bed with you.
Yes, my dear, said Limbeck, adjusting the spectacles that Jara had with well-meaning kindness stuck on lopsided. Looking through them that way, with one eyeglass up and the other down, made him nauseous.
I think that would be a good idea. I do feel tired.
He sighed and hung his head.
Very tired.
Walking to the ramshackle stairs, Limbeck was startled to feel a wet tongue lick across his knuckles. It was Haplo's dog, looking up at him, wagging its tail. I understand, the animal seemed to say, its unspoken words startlingly clear in Limbeck's mind. I'm sorry. Dog, Haplo spoke to it sharply, calling it back.
No, that's all right, said Limbeck, reaching down to give the animal's sleek head a gingerly pat. I don't mind.
Dog, come! Haplo's voice had an almost angry edge to it. The dog hurried back to its master's side, and Limbeck retired up the stairs.
He's so very idealistic, said Jara,
gazing after Limbeck in admiration mixed with exasperation.
And not at all practical. I just don't know what to do.
Keep him around, suggested Haplo. He stroked the dog's long nose to indicate that all was forgiven and forgotten. The animal lay down, rolled over on its side, and closed its eyes. He gives your evolution a high moral tone. You'll need that when blood starts to flow. Jara looked worried.
You think it will come to that?
Inevitable, he said, shrugging. You said as much yourself to Limbeck.
I know. It seems, as you say, that it is inevitable, that this is the natural end of what we began long ago. Yet it has seemed to me lately,
she turned her eyes to Haplo,
that we never seriously turned our thoughts to violence until you came. Sometimes I wonder if you aren't really a god.
Why is that? Haplo smiled.
Your words have a strange power over us. I hear them and I keep hearing them, not in my head, but in my heart.
She placed her hand on her breast, pressing it as if it pained her.
And because they're in my heart, I can't seem to think about them rationally. I just want to react, to go out and do something. Make somebody pay for what we've suffered, what we've endured.
Haplo rose from the chair and came over to Jara, kneeling down so that he put himself at eye level with the short, stocky Geg.
And why shouldn't you?
He said softly, so softly that she couldn't hear over the whumping, whooshing of the Kixie-Winsie. Yet she knew what he said, and the pain in her heart increased.
Why shouldn't you make them pay? How many of your people have lived and died down here, and all for what? To serve a machine that eats up your land, that destroys your homes, that takes your lives and gives nothing to you in return. You've been used, betrayed. It's your right, your duty to strike back.
I will.
Jara was caught, mesmerized by the man's crystal blue eyes. Slowly the hand over her heart clenched into a fist. Haplo, smiling his quiet smile, rose and stretched.
I think I'll join our friend in a nap. It's liable to be a long night.
Haplo, called Jara, you said you come from below us, from a realm that that no one knows is down there.
He did not reply, merely looked at her.
You were slaves. You told us that. But what you haven't told us is how you came to crash on our isle. You weren't...
She paused and licked her lips as if to make the words come more easily.
Running away.
One corner of the man's mouth twitched.
No, I wasn't running. You see, Jara, we won our fight. We are slaves no longer. I've been sent to free others.
The dog raised its head, turning to stare sleepily at Haplo. Seeing him leaving, the dog yawned and got up, hind end first, stretching out its front legs luxuriously. Yawning again, it rocked forward, stretching the back legs, then lazily accompanied its master up the stairs. Jara watched, then shook her head and was sitting down to finish Limbeck's speech when a thumping against the curtain recalled her to her duties. There were people to meet, pamphlets to be delivered, the hall to be inspected, parades to be organized. The revolution just wasn't much fun anymore. Haplo mounted the stairs carefully, keeping to the inside against the wall. The knobwood boards were cracked and rotting. Large, snaggle-toothed gaps waited to snare the unwary and send them crashing down to the floor below. Once inside his room, he lay down on the bed, but not to sleep. The dog jumped up on the bed next to him and rested its head on the man's chest, bright eyes fixed on his face. The woman is good, but she won't serve our purpose. She thinks too much, as my lord would say, and that makes her dangerous. What we need in this realm to foment chaos is a fanatic. Limbeck would be ideal, but he must have that idealistic bubble of his burst. And I've got to leave this place to carry on with my mission, investigate the upper realms and do what I can to prepare the way for the coming of my lord. My ship is destroyed. I have to find another, but how?
Musing, he fondled the dog's soft ears. The animal, sensing the man's tension, remained awake, lending its small support, and slowly Haplo relaxed. Opportunity would come. He knew it. He had only to watch for it and take advantage of it. The dog closed its eyes with a contented sigh and slept, and after a few moments, so did Haplo. Chapter 31. Rome, Drevlin, Low Realm.
Alfred. Sir? Do you understand what they're saying?
Hugh motioned to Bane, chatting with the Geg, the two of them scrambling across the Coralite. Storm clouds gathered at their backs, and the wind was rising and keened eerily among the bits and pieces of lightning-blasted Coralite. Ahead of them was the city Bane had seen, or rather not a city, but a machine, or perhaps a machine that was a city.
No, sir, said Alfred, looking directly at Bane's back and speaking more loudly than was usual for him. I do not speak the language of these people. I do not believe that there are many of our race, or the elves either, for that matter, who do.
A few of the elves speak it, those who captain the waterships. But if you don't speak it, and I assume that Stephen didn't, then where did his highness learn it?
How can you ask, sir?
Said Alfred, glancing significantly toward the heavens. He wasn't referring to the storm clouds. Up there, far above the maelstrom, was the High Realm, where dwelt the Mysteriarchs in their self-imposed exile, living in a world said by legend to be wealthy beyond the dreams of the greediest man and beautiful beyond the imagining of the most fanciful.
Understanding the language of a different race or culture is one of the simpler of the magical spells. I wouldn't be surprised if that amulet he wears...
Oh! Alfred's feet decided to take a side trip down a hole, and took the rest of Alfred with them. The Geg stopped and looked around in alarm at the man's cry. Bane said something, laughing, and he and the Geg continued on their way. Hugh extricated Alfred, and keeping his hand on his arm, guided him rapidly over the rough ground. The first raindrops were falling out of the sky, hitting the Coralite with loud splatters. Alfred cast an uneasy sidelong glance at Hugh, and the hand read the unspoken appeal to keep his mouth shut. In that appeal, Hugh had his answer, and it wasn't the one Alfred had given for Bane's benefit. Of course Alfred spoke the Geg's language. No one listened intently to a conversation he couldn't understand. And Alfred had been listening intently to Bane and the Geg. What was more interesting to Hugh's mind was that Alfred was keeping his knowledge secret from the prince. Hugh thoroughly approved spying on his highness, but that opened the other nagging question, where and why had a chamberlain learned to speak Geg? Who or what was Alfred Montbank? The storm broke in all its deadly fury, and the humans and the Gegs made for the city of Wome at a dead run. Rain fell in a gray wall in front of them, partially obscuring their vision. But the noise made by the machine was fortunately so loud that they could hear it over the storm, feel its vibrations underfoot, and knew they were headed in the right direction. A crowd of Gegs were waiting by an open doorway for them and hustled them all inside the machine. The sounds of the storm ceased, but the sounds of the machine were louder, clanking and banging above, around, below, and beyond. Several Gegs, who appeared to be armed guards of some sort, plus a Geg dressed up to look like an elf lord's footman, were waiting, somewhat nervously, to greet them.
Bane, what's going on? Hugh demanded loudly, shouting to be heard above the racket made by the machine. Who is this guy, and what does he want?
Bane looked up at Hugh with an ingenuous grin, obviously highly pleased with himself and his newfound power.
He's the king of his people, shouted Bane.
What?
King! He's going to take us to some sort of judgment hall.
Can't he take us somewhere quiet?
Hugh's head was beginning to throb. Bane turned to the king with the question. To Hugh's amazement, all the Gegs stared at him in horror, shaking their heads emphatically.
What the hell is the matter with them?
The prince began to giggle.
They think you've asked for a place to go to die.
At this juncture, the Geg dressed in silk hose, knee breeches, and a worn velvet doublet was introduced to Bane by the Geg king. The velvet-clad Geg threw himself to his knees. Taking Bane's hand, he pressed it against his forehead.
Who do they think you are, kid? Hugh asked.
A god, Bane answered airily. One they've been looking for, it seems. I'm going to pass judgment on them.
The Gegs led their newly discovered gods through the streets of Wome, streets that ran up, under, and straight through the Kixi-Winzi. Hugh the Hand was not awed by many things in this world. Not even death impressed him much. But he was awed by the great machine. It flashed, it glittered, it sparkled. It whumped and thwanged and hissed. It pumped and whirled and shot out blasts of searing hot steam. It created arcs of sizzling blue lightning. It soared higher than he could see, delved deeper than he could imagine. Huge gears engaged, huge wheels revolved, huge boilers boiled. It had arms and hands and legs and feet, all made of shining metal, all busily engaged in going somewhere other than where they were.
It had eyes that shed a blinding light and mouths that screeched and hooted. Geggs crawled over it, climbed up it, clambered down into it, turned it, tapped it, and tended it with obvious loving care and devotion. Bane, too, was overwhelmed. He gazed with wide-open eyes, his mouth gaping in ungodlike wonder.
"This is amazing," breathed the boy. "I've never seen anything like this."
"You haven't, your worship?"
exclaimed the High Froman, looking at the child god in astonishment.
"But you gods built it!"
Yes, Bane stammered. "It's just that I meant I'd never seen anything like the way you're taking care of it,"
he finished with a rush, exhaling the words in relief.
"Yes," said the High Clerk with dignity, his face glowing with pride. "We take excellent care of it."
The prince bit his tongue. He wanted very much to ask what this wondrous machine did, but it was obvious that this little king fellow expected him to know everything, not an unreasonable assumption in a god. Bane was on his own in this, too, his father having imparted to him all the information he had on the great machine of the Low Realm. This being a god wasn't as easy as it had first appeared, and the prince began regretting he'd agreed to it so fast. There was this judgment thing. Who was he judging, and why? Would he be sending anyone to the dungeons? He really needed to find out, but how? The little king fellow was, Bane decided, just a bit too shrewd. He was very respectful and polite, but the boy saw that when he wasn't looking, the Geg was scrutinizing him with a gaze that was sharp and penetrating. Walking along on the prince's right, however, was another Geg who reminded the child of a performing monkey he'd seen once at court. Bane guessed from what he'd heard that the beruffled, beribboned, velvet-lined Geg had something to do with the religion in which the boy had suddenly found himself so intimately involved. This Geg didn't appear to be all that bright, and the prince decided to turn to him for answers.
"Pardon me," said the boy with a charming smile for the head clerk, "but I didn't catch your name."
"Wes Wrenchranger, your worship," said the Geg, bowing as best he could for his stoutness, and nearly tripping on his long beard. "I have the honor to be your worship's head clerk."
"Whatever that is," Bane muttered to himself. Outwardly, he smiled and nodded and gave every indication that nowhere else on Grevlin could he have found a Geg more suited for that position. Sidling close to the head clerk, Bane slipped his hand into the Geg's hand, a proceeding which caused the head clerk to swell rather alarmingly and cast a glance of supreme self-satisfaction at his brother-in-law, the High Froman. Darrell paid little attention. The crowds lining the streets to see them were getting unruly. He was glad to see the coppers reacting to it. For the moment, they appeared to have matters under control, but he knew he would need to keep a watchful eye on things. He only hoped the child god couldn't understand what some of the Geggs were shouting. Damn that Limbeck, anyway. Fortunately for Darrell, the child god was completely absorbed in his own problems.
"Perhaps you could help me, head clerk," said Bane, flushing shyly and very prettily.
"I would be honored, your worship."
"You know, it's been an awfully long time since we, your gods, what did you call us?"
"The Mangers, your worship. That is what you call yourselves, isn't it?"
"Yes, oh yes, Mangers. It's just that, well, as I was saying, we Mangers have been away an awfully long time."
"Many centuries, your worship," said the head clerk.
"Yes, many centuries. And we've noticed that quite a few things have changed since we were away."
Bane drew a deep breath. This was coming easier all the time.
"Therefore, we've decided that this judgment thing should be changed as well."
The head clerk felt some of his smugness begin to drain from him. He glanced uneasily at the High Froman. If he, the head clerk, screwed up the judgment, it would be the last screw he ever turned.
"I'm not quite certain what you mean, your worship."
"Modernize it. Bring it up to date," suggested Bane.
The head clerk appeared terribly confused. How could you change something that had never before happened? Still, he supposed that the gods must have had it planned out.
"I guess it would be all right."
"Never mind, I can see you're uncomfortable with the idea," said the prince, patting the head clerk on his velvet-covered arm. "I've got a suggestion. You tell me the way you want me to handle it, and I'll do it just like you say."
The head clerk's face brightened.
"You can't believe how wonderful this moment is for me, your worship. I've dreamed of it for so long. And now to have the judgment go just as I've always imagined."
He wiped tears from his eyes.
"Yes, yes," said Bane.
He noted that the High Froman was watching them with narrowed eyes and edging nearer all the time. He might have stopped their conversation before this, except that it was undoubtedly considered bad manners to interrupt a god in confidential conference.
"Go on."
"Well, I always pictured all the Geggs, or at least as many as we could get in there, dressed in their very best clothes, standing in the factory. You would be there, seated in the Manger's chair, of course."
"Of course, and..."
"And I would be there, standing before the crowd in my new head clerk suit that I would have made specially for the occasion."
White, I think, would be proper, with black bows at the knees, nothing too overdone. Very tasteful. And then?
The High Foreman would be standing there with us, too, I suppose, Your Worship. That is, unless we could find something else for him to do. You see, Your Worship, what he'll find fit to wear is going to be a problem. Perhaps with this modernization you were discussing, we might dispense with him.
I'll think about it. Bane gripped the feather amulet and tried very hard to be patient. Go on, we're all up in front of the crowd. I stand up and I... He looked expectantly at the head clerk.
Why, you judge us, Your Worship.
The prince had the sudden satisfying vision of sinking his teeth into the Geg's velvet arm. Reluctantly banishing the thought, he drew a deep breath.
Fine. I judge you. And then what happens? I know. We'll declare a holiday.
I don't really think there'll be time for that, do you, Your Worship?
Said the Geg, looking at Bane with a puzzled expression.
Perhaps not, stammered the prince. I forgot about the other. When we're all...
Slipping his hand from the hand of the head clerk, the boy wiped his sweating forehead. It was certainly hot inside the machine, hot and noisy. His throat was getting sore from shouting.
What is it we're all doing now, after I've judged you?
Why, that depends on whether or not you've found us worthy, Your Worship.
Let's say I find you worthy, Bane said, gritting his teeth. Then what?
Then we ascend, Your Worship.
Ascend?
The prince looked at the catwalks running hither and thither above him. The head clerk, misunderstanding his gaze, sighed with happiness. His face glowing beatifically, he lifted his hands.
Yes, Your Worship, right straight up into heaven.
Marching along behind Bane and his adoring Geggs, Hugh diverted one eye to his surroundings and the other to the prince. He soon ceased to try to keep track of where they were, admitting to himself that he could never find his way out of the insides of the machine without help. News of their coming had apparently rushed on ahead of them. Thousands of Geggs lined the halls and corridors of the machine, staring, shouting, and pointing. Geggs, busy with their work, actually turned their heads, bestowing on Hugh and his companions, had they known it, a high honor by forgetting their tasks for a few seconds. The reaction of the Geggs, however, was mixed. Some were cheering with enthusiasm, but others appeared to be angry. Hugh was more interested in Prince Bane and what he was doing in such close confab with the ruffled Geg. Silently cursing himself for never having bothered to learn any of the Geg language when he was with the elves, Hugh felt a tug on his sleeve and turned his attention to Alfred.
Sir, said Alfred. Have you noticed what the crowd is yelling?
Gibberish, as far as I'm concerned. But you understand it, don't you, Alfred?
Alfred flushed deeply. I am sorry I had to conceal my knowledge from you, Sir Hugh, but I believed it important that I conceal it from another. He glanced at the prince. When you asked me that question, it was just possible that he could have heard my answer, and so I felt I had no choice.
Hugh made a deprecating motion with his hand. Alfred had a point. It had been the hand who had made the mistake.
He should have realized what Alfred was doing and never spoken up. It was just that never in Hugh's life had he felt so damn helpless.
Where did you learn to speak, Geg?
The study of the Gegs and the Low Realm has been a hobby of mine, sir, answered Alfred with the shy, proud consciousness of a true enthusiast. I dare say I have one of the finest collections of books written about their culture in the Mid-Realm. If you would be interested when we return, I'll be happy to show you...
If you left those books in the palace, you can forget them. Unless you plan on asking Stephen to give you leave to run back in and pick up your things.
You're right, sir, of course. How stupid of me.
Alfred's shoulders sagged.
All my books. I don't suppose I'll ever see them again.
What were you saying about the crowd?
Oh, yes.
The Chamberlain glanced around at the cheering and occasionally jeering Geggs. Some are calling out, down with the Foeman's god, and we want Limbeck's god.
Limbeck? What does that mean?
It's a Geg name, I believe, sir. It means to distill or extract. If I might make a suggestion, I think...
Instinctively he lowered his voice, and in the noise and commotion, Hugh lost his words.
Talk louder, no one can understand us, can they?
Oh, I suppose not, said Alfred, light dawning. That hasn't occurred to me. I was saying, sir, that there might be another human such as ourselves down here.
Or an elf, that's more likely. Either way, odds are they've got a ship we can use to get out of here.
Yes, sir, I thought that might be the case.
We've got to see this Limbeck and his god or whatever.
That shouldn't be difficult, sir. Not if our little god commands it.
Our little god seems to have gotten himself in some sort of trouble,
said Hugh, his gaze going to the prince.
Look at his face.
Oh, dear, murmured Alfred.
Bane had twisted his head back to search for his companions. His cheeks were pale, his blue eyes wide. Biting his lip, he made a hurried motion for them to come up to him. An entire squadron of armed Geggs marched between them and the prince. Hugh shook his head. Bane gazed at him pleadingly. Alfred, looking sympathetic, gestured at the crowd. Bane was a prince. He knew what was due an audience. Sighing, he turned around and began to wave his small hand feebly and without enthusiasm. "I was afraid of this," said Alfred.
"What do you think's happened?"
"The boy said something about the Geggs thinking he was the god who had come to judge them. He spoke about it glibly, but it is very serious to the Geggs. According to their legends, it was the Mangers who built the great machine. The Geggs were to serve it until the day of judgment, when they would be rewarded and carried up into the higher realms. That was how the isle Geggs Hope came by its name."
"Mangers? Who are these Mangers?"
"The Sartan."
"Devil take us," the hand swore. "You mean they think the kid is one of the Sartan?"
"It would seem so, sir."
"I don't suppose he could fake it with help from Daddy?"
"No, sir. Not even a Mysteriarch of the Seventh House, such as his father, possesses magical powers compared to those of the Sartan. After all," said Alfred, gesturing, "they built all this." Hugh cared little about that now.
"Great, just great. And what do you think they'll do when they find out we're impostors?"
"I couldn't say, sir. Ordinarily the Geggs are peaceful, gentle people, but then I don't suppose they've ever had anyone pretend to be one of their gods before. In addition, they seem to be in a turmoil over something." Alfred, looking at the crowds growing increasingly hostile, shook his head.
"I would say, sir, that we've come at rather a bad time."
Chapter 32. Wom Drevlin, Low Realm. The Geggs took the gods to the factory, the same place where Limbeck had been given his trial. They had some difficulty entering due to the crowds of milling Geggs massed outside. Hugh couldn't understand a word they were shouting. Despite that, it was obvious to him that the populace was divided into two distinct and highly vocal factions, with a large segment who seemed unable to make up their minds. The two factions appeared to feel strongly about their beliefs, because Hugh saw fights break out on several occasions. He remembered what Alfred had said about the Geggs being ordinarily peaceful and gentle. "We've come at rather a bad time." No kidding. It looked to be in the middle of a revolution of some sort. The coppers kept back the crowd, and the prince and his companions managed to squeeze through the stout bodies into the relative quiet of the factory, relative to the fact that the whanging and banging of the Kixiewinsy was constantly in the background. Once inside, the High Froman held a hasty meeting with the coppers. The little king's face was grave, and Hugh observed several times that he shook his head. The hand didn't give a half barrel for the Geggs, but he had lived long enough to know that being caught in a country undergoing political upheaval was not conducive to a long and healthy life. "Excuse us." He approached the head clerk, who bowed and stared at him with the blank, bright smile of one who doesn't understand a word that is being said to him, but who is trying to appear as if he did, in order not to be rude.
"We have to have a little talk with your guard."
Gripping Bane firmly by the shoulder, ignoring the boy's yelps and squirming, Hugh marched the prince across the vast empty floor over to where Alfred stood gazing up at a statue of a hooded man holding what appeared to be an eyeball in his hand. "Do you know what they expect me to do?" Bane demanded of Alfred as soon as they neared him. "They expect me to transport them up into heaven." "May I remind His Highness that he brought this on himself by telling them he was a god?" The child's head drooped. He stole up to Alfred's side and slipped a hand in the chamberlain's. Lower lip quivering, Bane said softly, "I'm sorry, Alfred. I was afraid they were going to hurt you and Sir Hugh, and it was the only thing I could think of to do." Strong hands jerked Bane around. Rough fingers bit into his shoulders. Hugh knelt down and looked straight into the child's eyes, behind which he wanted to see cunning and malevolent purpose. All he saw were the eyes of a frightened kid. It angered him.
"All right, Your Highness, you go on fooling the Geggs as long as you can. Anything to get us out of here. But we just want to make it plain that you don't fool us one bit, not any more. Those phony tears better dry up and you better listen. You and Daddy both."
He glanced at the feather as he spoke, and the boy's hand closed over it protectively.
"Unless you can hoist these dwarves into the skies, you better be prepared to do some fast thinking. I don't suppose these people will take kindly to being hoodwinked."
"Sir Hugh," warned Alfred, "we're being watched." The hand looked over to the High Froman, who was observing the proceedings with interest. Releasing the boy, patting him on the shoulders, Hugh smiled.
"What is it you plan to do, Your Highness?"
he muttered in an undertone. Bane gulped back his tears. Fortunately, there was no need to keep their voices lowered. The rhythmic pounding and thumping of the machine muffled everything, including thought.
"I've decided I'll tell them I've judged them and found them wanting. They haven't earned the right to go up to heaven."
Hugh glanced at Alfred. The man shook his head.
"It would be very dangerous, Your Highness, if you said such a thing in the state of turmoil that seems to have gripped the realm.
The Geggs might well turn on us. The child's eyes blinked rapidly, their gaze shifting quickly from Alfred to Hugh and back again. Bane was obviously frightened. He had plunged in over his head and felt himself sinking. Worse still, he must know that the only two who could save him had very good reasons for letting him drown.
What do we do?
We. Hugh would have liked nothing better than to leave the changeling on this storm-swept patch of rock. He knew he wouldn't, however. Enchantment? Or did he just feel sorry for the brat? Neither, he assured himself, still planning to use the kid to make his fortune. There's talk of another god down here. Limbeck's god, said Alfred.
How did you know that?
Bane flared.
You can't understand what they're saying.
Yes, I can, Your Highness. I speak some Geg.
You lied!
The child gazed at him in shock.
How could you, Alfred? I trusted you.
The chamberlain shook his head. I think it best for all of us to admit that none of us trust the other.
Who can blame me? Cried Bane with glittering innocence. This man tried to kill me. And for all I know, Alfred, you were helping him.
That is not true, Your Highness, yet I can understand how you might come to think so. But I have not meant to make accusations. I think it behooves us to realize that though we do not trust each other, our lives in total now depend on each other individually. I think...
Too much, Hugh broke in. The kid understands, don't you, Bane? And drop the Babe Lost in the Woods Act. We both know who and what you are. I presume that you want to get out of here, go up and pay Dad a visit. The only way you're going to get off this rock is with a ship, and I'm the only pilot you've got. Alfred here knows something about these people and how they think. At least he claims he does. He's right when he says we're each other's only chance in this game, so I suggest that you and Daddy there play along nicely. Bane stared at him. His eyes were no longer the eyes of a child who was eagerly studying the world. They were the eyes of one who knows all about it. Hugh saw himself reflected in those eyes, saw a chill, unloved childhood, saw a child who had unwrapped all of life's pretty presents and discovered the boxes contained filth. Like me, Hugh thought, he no longer believes in the bright, the shining, the beautiful. He knows what's underneath.
You're not treating me like a kid, said Bane, wary and cautious.
Are you one?
Hugh asked bluntly.
No.
Bane clasped the feather tightly as he spoke and repeated more loudly,
No, I'm not. I'll work with you, I promise, so long as you don't betray me. If you do, either of you, then I'll make you regret it.
The blue eyes gleamed with a most unchildlike shrewdness.
Fair enough. I give you each the same promise.
Alfred?
The chamberlain looked at them in despair and sighed.
Must it be like this? Trusting only because each of us holds a knife in the other's back?
You lied about speaking Geg. You didn't tell me the truth about the kid until it was almost too late. What else have you lied about, Alfred?
Hugh demanded. The chamberlain went white. His mouth worked, but he couldn't answer. Finally, he managed to squeeze out, I promise.
All right, that's done. Now, we've got to find out about this other god. He could be our way off this rock. Chances are it's an elf whose ship got caught in the storm and sucked down.
I could tell the High Froman that I want to meet this god.
Bane was swift to see and understand the possibilities.
I'll tell him that I can't judge the Geggs until I find out what this fellow god of mine thinks about the matter.
The boy smiled sweetly.
Who knows? It could take us days to come up with the answer. But would an elf help us?
If he's in as much trouble down here as we are, he would. My ship's wrecked. His probably is too. But we might be able to use parts of one to fix the other. Shh! You've got company.
The High Froman joined them, the head clerk bustling importantly along behind.
When would your worship like to commence the judgment?
Bane drew himself up to his full height and managed to look offended.
I heard the people shouting something about another god being present in your land. Why wasn't I informed of this?
Because, your worship, said the High Froman, casting a reproachful glance at the head clerk, this is a god who claims he isn't a god. He claims that none of you are gods, but says you are mortals who have enslaved us.
Hugh contained himself patiently during this conversation that he couldn't understand. Alfred was listening to the Geggs with close attention, and the hand kept close watch on Alfred's face. He did not miss the man's dismayed reaction over what was being said. The assassin ground his teeth, frustrated nearly to the point of madness. Their lives were dependent on a 10-cycle kid who at this point looked like he might very well burst into tears. Prince Bane got a grip on himself, however. Pointed chin in the air, he made some answer that apparently eased the situation, for Hugh saw Alfred's face relax. The chamberlain even nodded slightly before he caught himself, aware that he shouldn't be reacting. The kid has nerve, he's quick-thinking. Hugh twisted his beard.
And perhaps I'm enthralled, he reminded himself.
Bring this god to me, said Bane, with an imperious air that made him, for a brief moment, resemble King Stephen.
If your worship wishes to see him, he and the gig who brought him here are speaking at a rally tonight. You could confront him publicly.
Very well, said Bane, not liking it, but not knowing what other response to make.
Now, perhaps your worship would care to rest. I notice that one member of your party is injured.
The gig's glance went to Hugh's torn and blood-stained shirt sleeve.
I could send for a healer.
Hugh saw the glance, understood, and made a negating gesture.
Thank you, his injury isn't serious, said Bane. But you could send us food and water.
The High Froman bowed.
Is that all I can do for your worship?
Yes, thank you. That will be all, said Bane, failing to conceal the relief in his voice.
The gods were shown to chairs placed at the feet of the Manga, possibly to provide inspiration. The head clerk would have liked very much to stay and visit, but Darrow nabbed his brother-in-law by the velvet sleeve and dragged him, protesting volubly, away.
What are you doing? Raved the head clerk. How could you risk insulting his worship by saying such a thing, implying that he isn't a god? And that talk about slaves!
Shut up and listen to me, snapped Darrow Longshoreman.
He'd had his fill of gods. One more, your worship, and he thought he'd gag.
Either these folk are gods or they're not. If they're not, and this Limbeck turns out to be right, what do you think will happen to us, who've spent our lives telling our people that we were serving gods?
The head clerk stared at his brother-in-law. Slowly his face drained of all its ruddy color. He gulped.
Exactly,
Darrow nodded emphatically, his beard wagging.
Now, suppose they are gods. Do you really want to be judged and taken up into heaven? Or do you like it down here, the way things used to be before all this hullabaloo started?
The head clerk considered. He was very fond of being head clerk. He lived well. Gags respected him, bowed and took off their hats when he walked down the street. He didn't have to serve the Kixie-Winsie, except when and where he chose to put in an appearance. He got invited to all the best parties. When you came right down to it, what more did heaven have to offer?
You're right, he was forced to admit, though it galled him to do so. What do we do?
I'm working on it, said the High Froman. Just leave it to me.
I'd give 100 barrels to know what those two are talking about.
Hugh watched the two gags walk off in close conversation. I don't like this at all, said Alfred. This other god, whoever it is fomenting rebellion and chaos down here. I wonder why. The elves wouldn't have any reason to upset things in the low realm, would they?
No. It's to their advantage to keep the gigs quiet and hard at work. But there's nothing we can do, I guess, except to go to this rally tonight and hear what this god has to say.
Yes, said Alfred absently.
Hugh glanced at the man. The high domed forehead glistened with sweat, and his eyes had acquired a fevered luster. His skin was ashen, his lips gray. He hadn't, it occurred to Hugh, suddenly fallen over anything in the last hour.
You don't look good. Are you all right?
I'm not feeling very well, Sir Hugh. Nothing serious, just a reaction from the crash. I'll be fine. Please don't worry about me. Your Highness understands the serious nature of tonight's encounter?
Bane gave Alfred a thoughtful, considering look.
Yes, I understand. I'll do my best to help, although I'm not certain what it is I'm supposed to do.
The boy appeared to be sincere, but Hugh could still see that innocent smile as the child fed him poison. Was Bane, in truth, playing the game with them? Or was he merely moving them ahead one more square? Chapter 33. Wome, Drevlin, Low Realm. A commotion outside the hole in the wall attracted Jara's attention. She had just put the finishing touches on Limbeck's speech. Laying it down, she went to what served as the door and peered out the curtain. The crowds in the street had grown larger, she saw with satisfaction. But the wops assigned to guard the door were arguing loudly with several other gags attempting to enter. At the sight of Jara, their clamor increased. What is it? She asked. The gags began shouting at once, and it took her some time to quiet them down. When she had done so and had heard what they had to say, she gave instructions and re-entered WAP headquarters. What's going on? Hapla was standing on the stairs, the dog at his side.
I'm sorry the commotion woke you, Jara apologized. It's nothing, really.
I wasn't asleep. What is it?
Jara shrugged.
The High Froman's come up with his own god. I might have expected something like this of Darrow Longshoreman. Well, it won't work, that's all.
His own god. Haplo descended the stairs with a step swift and light as a cat's. Tell me.
Surely you can't take this seriously. You know there are no such things as gods. Darrow probably told the Welves we were threatening them, and they've sent someone down here to try to convince my people that, yes, we Welves really are gods.
Is this god an elf? A Welf?
I don't know. Most of our people have never seen a Welf.
I don't suppose anyone knows what they look like. All I know is that it seems this god is a child, and he's been telling everyone he's come to judge us, and he's going to do so at the rally tonight and prove that we're wrong. Of course, you can deal with him.
Of course, murmured Haplo.
Jara was bustling about. I've got to make certain everything's arranged at the Together Hall. She threw a shawl around her shoulders. On her way out the hole in the wall, she paused and looked back. Don't tell Limbeck about this. He'll get himself all worked up. It'll be better to take him completely by surprise. That way he won't have time to think. Thrusting aside the curtain, she stepped outside to the sound of loud cheers. Left alone, Haplo threw himself in a chair. The dog, sensing his master's mood, thrust his muzzle comfortingly into the man's hand.
The Sartan, do you think, boy?
Mused Haplo, absently scratching the dog beneath the chin.
They're as close to a god as these people are likely to find in a godless universe. And what do I do if it is? I can't challenge this god and reveal to him my own powers. The Sartan must not be alerted to our escape from their prison. Not yet, not until my lord is fully prepared.
He sat in thoughtful, brooding silence. The hand stroking the animal slowed in its caress and soon ceased altogether. The dog, knowing itself no longer needed, settled down to the man's feet, chin on its paws, its liquid eyes reflecting the concern in the eyes of its master.
Ironic, isn't it? Said Haplo,
and at the voice the dog's ears pricked, and it glanced up at him, one white eyebrow slightly raised.
Me with the powers of a god, and unable to use them.
Drawing back the bandage that swathed his hand, he ran a finger over the blue and red spider-web lines of the Sigler, whose fantastic whorls and patterns decorated his skin.
I could build a ship in a day, fly out of here tomorrow if I so chose. I could show these dwarves power they've never imagined. I could become a god for them, lead them to war against the humans and the wells.
Haplo smiled, but his face grew immediately sober.
Why not? What would it matter?
A strong desire to use his power came over him. Not only to use the magic, but to use it to conquer, to control, to lead. The Geggs were peaceful, but Haplo knew that wasn't the true nature of dwarves. Somehow the Sartan had managed to beat it out of them, reduce them to the mindless, machine-serving Geggs that they had become. It should be easy to uncover the fierce pride, the legendary courage of the dwarves. The ashes appeared cold, but surely a flame must flicker somewhere.
I could raise an army, build ships.
No, what has gotten into me? Haplo angrily jerked the cloth back over his hand. The dog, cringing at the sharp tone, looked up apologetically, thinking perhaps that it had been at fault.
It's my true nature, the nature of the patrons, and it would lead me into disaster. My lord warned me of this. I must move slowly. The Geggs are not ready, and I'm not the one who should lead them. Their own Limbeck. Somehow I must blow on the spark that is Limbeck. As for this child god, there's nothing to be done but wait and see and trust in myself. If it is a Sartan, then that might be all for the better, right, boy?
Leaning down, Haplo thumped the animal on its flank. The dog, pleased at the return of its master's good humor, closed its eyes and sighed deeply.
And if it is a Sartan, muttered Haplo beneath his breath, leaning back in the small, uncomfortable chair and stretching his legs, may my lord keep me from ripping out the bastard's heart.
By the time Jara had come back, Limbeck was awake and anxiously perusing his speech, and Haplo had made a decision. Well, said Jara brightly, unwinding her shawl from around her ample shoulders, everything is all ready for tonight. I think, my dear, that this will be the biggest rally yet.
We need to talk to the god, interrupted Haplo in his quiet voice.
Jara flashed him a look, reminding him that this subject was not to be mentioned in front of Limbeck.
God?
Limbeck peered at them from behind the spectacles perched precariously on his nose.
What god? What's going on?
He had to know, Haplo mollified an angry Jara. It's best to always know as much as you can about the enemy.
Enemy? What enemy?
Limbeck, pale but calm, had risen to his feet.
You don't seriously believe that they are what they claim. Mangus, do you?
Demanded Jara, staring at Haplo with narrowed eyes, arms akimbo.
No, and that is what we must prove.
You said yourself this was undoubtedly a plot by the High Foeman to discredit your movement. If we can capture this being who calls himself a god, and can prove publicly that he's not,
then we can cast down the High Foeman, cried Jara, clapping her hands together eagerly.
Haplo, pretending to scratch the dog, lowered his head to hide his smile. The animal gazed up at his master with a wistful, uneasy aspect.
Certainly there's that possibility, but we must take this one step at a time, said Haplo after a pause, seeming to give the matter grave consideration.
First, it's essential that we find out who this god really is, and why he's here.
Who is here?
Limbeck's spectacles slid down his nose. He pushed them back and raised his voice.
Tell me...
I'm sorry, my dear, it all happened while you were asleep.
Jara informed him of the arrival of the High Froman's god, and how he had paraded the child through the city streets, and what the people were saying and doing, and how some of them believed the child was a god, and some believed he wasn't, and...
And there's going to be trouble, that's what you mean, don't you?
Concluded Limbeck. Sinking down into his chair, he stared bleakly at her.
What if they really are the Mangers? What if I've been wrong and they come to pass judgment on the people? They'll be offended and they might abandon us again.
He twisted the speech in his hands.
I might have brought great harm to all our people.
Jara, looking exasperated, opened her mouth, but Haplo shook his head at her. Limbeck, that is why we need to talk to them. If they are the Mangers, he corrected himself. Then we can explain and they'll understand, I'm sure.
I was so certain,
Limbeck cried woefully.
And you are right, my dear.
Jara knelt beside him and, putting her hands on his face, turned it so that he was forced to look at her.
Believe in yourself. This is an impostor brought by the High Froman. We'll prove that, and we'll prove that he and the clerks have been in league with those who have enslaved us. This could be our great chance, our chance to change our world.
Limbeck did not reply. Gently removing Jara's hands, he held them fast, thanking her silently for her comfort. But he lifted his head and fixed a troubled gaze on Haplo. You've gone too far to back out now, my friend, said the patron. Your people trust you, believe in you. You can't let them down.
But what if I'm wrong?
You're not, said Haplo with conviction. Even if this is a Manger, the Mangers are not gods and never were. They are human, like myself. They were endowed with great magical power, but they were mortal. If the High Froman claims the Manger is a god, just ask the Manger. If he really is one, he will tell you the truth. The Mangers always told the truth. They had gone throughout the world protesting that they were not divine, yet taking upon themselves the responsibilities of the divine. False humility to mask pride and ambition. If this was a true Sartan, he would refute his own godhood. If not, Haplo would know he was lying, and exposing him would be easy. Can we get in to see them? He asked Jara.
They're being held in the factory, she said, pondering. I don't know much about it, but we have those in our group who do. I'll ask them.
We should hurry. It's almost dark, and the meeting is supposed to commence in 2 hours' time. We should see them before that. Jara was on her feet and heading for the hole in the wall. Limbeck, sighing, leaned his head on his hand. His spectacles slid down his nose and dropped into his lap, where they lay unnoticed. The woman has the energy and determination, mused Haplo. Jara knows her limitations. She can make the vision reality, but it is Limbeck who has the eyes, half blind that they are, to see. I must show him the vision. Jara returned with several eager, grim-looking gegs.
There's a way in. Tunnels run underneath the floor and come up near the statue of the Manger.
Haplo nodded his head toward Limbeck. Jara understood.
Did you hear me, my dear? We can get inside the factory and talk to this so-called god. Do we go?
Limbeck raised his head. His face beneath the beard was pale, but there was an expression of determination.
Yes.
He raised a hand, stopping her from interrupting.
I've realized it doesn't matter if I'm right or if I'm wrong. All that matters is to discover the truth.
Chapter 34. Wom Drevlin, Low Realm. Two guide gegs, Limbeck, Jara, Haplo, and of course the dog, navigated a series of twisting, winding tunnels that intersected, bisected, and dissected the ground below the Kixiwinsy. The tunnels were old and marvelous in their construction, lined with stone that appeared from its regular shape to have been made either by the hand of man or the metal hands of the Kixiwinsy. Here and there, carved into the stones, were curious symbols. Limbeck was absolutely fascinated with these, and it was with some difficulty and a few tugs on his beard that Jara managed to persuade him that there was a need for hurry. Haplo could have told him much about these symbols. He could have told him they were in reality Sigla, the runes of the Sartan, and that it was the Sigla carved upon the stones that kept the tunnels dry despite the almost constant flow of rainwater dripping through the porous coralite. It was the Sigla that maintained the tunnels centuries after those who built them had left them. The patron was nearly as interested in the tunnels as Limbeck. It was becoming increasingly obvious to him that the Sartan had abandoned their work. Not only that, but they had left it unfinished. And that was not at all like these humans who had attained the power and the status of demigods.
The great machine, which, even far below ground, they could still feel throbbing and pulsing and pounding, was, Haplow had observed, running on its own, at its own whim, by its own design. And it was doing nothing, nothing creative that Haplow could see. He had traveled the length and breadth of Grevlin with Limbeck and the Whoppers, and everywhere he had gone he had inspected the great machine. It knocked over buildings, it dug holes, it built new buildings, it filled in holes, it roared and steamed and tooted and hummed, and did what it did with a wondrous amount of energy. But what it was doing was nothing. Once a month, so Haplow had heard, the Wells came down from above in their iron suits and their flying ships and picked up the precious substance, water. The Wells had been doing this for centuries, and the Geggs had come to believe that this was the ultimate purpose of their beloved and sacred machine, to produce water for these godlike Wells. But Haplow saw that the water was merely a byproduct of the Kixi-Winzi, perhaps even a waste product. The function of the fabulous machine was something grander, something far more magnificent than spitting out water to slake the thirst of the elven nation. But what that purpose was, and why the Sartan had left before it could be accomplished, was something Haplow could not begin to fathom. There was no answer for him in the tunnels. Possibly it lay ahead. He had learned, as had all the patrons, that impatience, any slip from the tightly held reins of control imposed upon themselves, could lead to disaster. The labyrinth was not kind to those with flaws. Patience, endless patience, that was one of the gifts the patrons had received from the labyrinth, though it came to them covered with their own blood. The Geggs were excited, noisy, and eager. Haplow walked through the tunnels after them, making no more noise than did his shadow cast by the light of Gegg glimmer lamps. The dog trotted along behind, silent and watchful as his master. "Are you certain this is the right way?" Jara asked more than once, when it seemed that they must be walking in endless circles. The guide Geggs assured her it was. It seemed that several years ago the Kixi-Winzi had taken it into its mechanical head that it should open the tunnels. It had done so, punching through the ground with its iron fists and feet. Geggs swarmed below, shoring up the walls and providing the machine support. Then, just as suddenly, the Kixi-Winzi changed its mind and launched off in a completely new direction. These particular Geggs had been part of the tunnel script and knew them as well as they knew their own houses. Unfortunately, the tunnels were not deserted, as Haplow had hoped. The Geggs now used them to get from one place to another, and the Whoppers on their way to the factory ran into large numbers of Geggs. The sight of Haplow created excitement. The guy Geggs felt called upon to tell everyone who he was and who Limbeck was, and almost all the Geggs that didn't have other, more pressing business decided to follow along. Soon there was a parade of Geggs tromping through the tunnels, heading for the factory. So much for secrecy and surprise. Haplow comforted himself with the knowledge that an army of Geggs mounted on shrieking dragons could have flown through the tunnel, and due to the noise of the machine, no one topside would be the wiser. "Here we are!" shouted one Gegg in a booming voice, pointing to a metal ladder leading up a shaft and into darkness. Glancing further down the tunnel, Haplow could see numerous other ladders placed at intervals.